You are listening to the Hostage to the Devil podcast. Some listeners may find this content disturbing.
Hello, Robert.
Marty, it's good to see you again.
Frequent visitor of the podcast.
I haunt the podcast.
Hostage to the podcast. Before we start, obviously this podcast episode is about your new book. Well, what I'd like to start with is talking to you about Father Martin, and if he was alive today, what do you think your discussions would be centered around?
Two words: underground church.
Right, meaning what?
Because the institution, as he said in many of his conversations and interviews in the 1990s, especially with Bernard Jansen, he said that already back then the church was going off the rails in terms of institutionalized heresy and apostasy. But he made very clear to say when he meant the church, he meant the administrative structures of the church, not what people call, they now refer to as the people of God or the laity. All right. For the laity who know what's going on, they are preserving the faith in their own way. However, you know, as we just saw with the recently wrapped up synod, there are a number of things that even as recently as Pope John Paul II and the late Pope Benedict XVI would argue are heretical positions. So his reaction would be two words: underground church.
And do you feel like, you know, obviously we all know Father Martin was a one-off and he was a very special sort of entity in this world. Do you believe that there's similar sort of priests to Malachy Martin in the sense of, do you feel that there are underground churches happening right now as we speak?
Yes, there are. Yes, there are. And when he spoke of the underground church, I don't want people to get the wrong idea. All right. It's not that it's a secret church or a hidden church. It's basically churches preserving traditional Roman doctrine as it has existed, you know, for the last two centuries up until about 1965, 1970. But you have to go look for them. It's the Society of St. Pius X that was started by Archbishop Lefebvre from France. It's the various independent but orthodox teaching Roman Catholic priests who say the old Roman rite of the Mass, as opposed to, for example, the bishops in Germany. They are now notorious for saying that the church has been wrong for 2,000 years on, and then fill in the topic. For example, homosexuality, abortion, gay marriage, female priests, etc. And they've been very blatant coming out and making those statements, because I think they know not that Francis is going to endorse them, but Francis will take no punitive action against them, because they feel that in the current Pope, they have a friend who will at least silently acquiesce to what they're saying.
Interesting. So, moving on to, congratulations on moving into your new sort of path in life, which is writing. Would you class yourself now as a novelist, or what would you call yourself now?
Unexpected writer. a very good friend of mine named Eric, 4.5 years ago when I first became disabled, he told me, he said, you have two paths ahead of you. You're at a Y in life. He said, on one hand, he said, you can marinate in bitterness at what life has dealt you, or he said, you can figure out what Rob version 2.0 looks like. And I took his advice, and on the recommendation of my wife, I wrote the novel Ebenezer Scrooge and the Ghost of Christmas Love, which is a follow-up to A Christmas Carol, as you know. And that's going to be published and distributed a year from now for next Christmas by Simon & Schuster.
Great, mate. Brilliant. So the hardest thing, like, for example, for me was calling myself a professional filmmaker or a film director or storyteller or whatever, purely because I wasn't I didn't believe in what I could do. It was, even when Hostage to the Devil went on Netflix in 2017, I still didn't feel right calling myself a film director or a filmmaker, but it just took somebody else to come along and say, no, you are an established filmmaker, film director. And it's a bit like yourself, you know, you will have a published book in the next year. So
exactly.
Congratulations.
Exactly.
Just like filmmaking, it's any film that's made is a mini miracle itself. And I would say I don't really know the book side of things, but writing books is just as daunting and just as crazy.
Well, because I've got a partial paralysis and motor control issues in this hand from the car accident, which happened on the very first day we began rolling film for Hostage to the Devil. You remember that well.
Oh, yeah.
Because of that, typing, traditional typing for me is a slog, as they say. But I eventually, by setting a goal of one page a day, after about a year and a half, 2 years, I managed to get a novel done. So
that's no mean thing.
But you're right. You're right. You know, even after you do it, you kind of have to, you look at the empirical evidence. In your case, a very well-received motion picture that was on Netflix and now YouTube. So you kind of pinch yourself and go, yeah, it's real. There it is. It's real. I directed it.
I was sort of refreshing at midnight on the launch night. I was sort of refreshing Netflix, and then it just popped up. But I would say, I do to this day believe that Hostage to the Devil was licensed by Netflix, because I did truly believe they thought they were getting like a horror exorcism documentary. Mm-hmm. When you sit down and watch the film, it's purely about the man. You know, the question in the film is this man an absolute sociopath? I think Bob Kaiser called him a mythomaniac, or is he a truth seeker, truth teller? You know, that's the core question throughout the film. And I do believe Netflix, I'm very grateful for them putting it on worldwide 4 years. I believe they didn't really know what they had until they had it in their catalog. And people struggle to even find it on Netflix. I do believe they put it down into the vault of Netflix catalog. And I'm not being negative here. I'm just saying that we are still trying to find a new home. So all the listeners out there, I'm thankful for your patience. And we will try and find a home for it. It's just finding the right home for it at the moment. And the industry's, you know, as many people know, is all over the place at the moment. But I truly believe we will find a new home for the film. And even with the podcast as well. The podcast is, you know, it started purely as a way to showcase a lot of interviews that didn't make the final cut. We had a lot of audio and a lot of interviews. I mean, a lot of people were left on the cutting room floor. So the podcast, really, the origin story of the podcast was purely just to let people listen to a lot of interviews that weren't featured in the film. It does take a long time, and I know people have been waiting for new podcast episodes. So again, I am thankful and grateful for their patience on that. I just feel like now, for me, the time is right to start creating more content with the podcast centered around Father Martin and his mission and a lot of his work. So let's bring us straight into your next chapter, no pun intended, but talk us through this new Maliki Martin book that you want to write and I'll go into writing.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Marty. The way I kind of, you know, Maliki used to say that there are no coincidences in the world of spirit. And I think I can apply that to there are no coincidences when talking about Father Maliki. And I am, to the best of my knowledge, and no one has corrected me. I am the last man standing who knew him on what you would call a day-to-day basis for the decade of the 1990s, the last decade he was alive. And many people have told me, Rob, you have an obligation to tell his story because there are aspects to Father Malachy as a priest and as a man that 99% of the people who've read his books or listened to him on either Bernard Janzen or Art Bell are not aware of. And when you go, those stories go with you.
Yep.
So it's going to be a biographic memoir that is, I think, going to open some people's eyes who have maybe straddled the fence a little bit with regard to, you know, was he real? Was he, as the late Robert Kaiser said, a mythomaniac, which he was not.
Well, it was actually Kaiser who pulled me up on the telephone, the numerous telephone conversations with Mr. Kaiser. And it was Robert who, you know, he asked me the question, so what do you believe, you know, with it in the man, you know, what are your thoughts on the man? And I, in a naive way, responded, I'm going to remain on the fence with this. And he sort of laughed down the phone. And he said, you're making a film about a man. You can't, as a filmmaker, storyteller, you have to, you know, you can't 100% be objective in a story. You have to have a belief. And yeah, and I'll tell you right now, a lot of people ask me my thoughts on the man, and I spent a long time researching him. And I got to the point where I just, a lot of dead ends about trying to prove a lot of facts or a lot of stories about the man. And I just came to the point where, you know what? I believed he was a truth seeker. He was a truth teller. He was flawed like all human beings on this earth. But I truly believe he was a truth seeker and a truth teller. And many can see that in the film. It does bleed into the narrative. But it was actually, it was funny that Kaiser actually pulled me up on that. And he said, you know, you can't remain on the fence with this man. He's, as we have found out, he's like Marmite. People loved him or hated him. And I know which camp that I naturally sort of moved into. So,
The other thing I was going to say was regarding Robert Kaiser was it's interesting that he didn't publish his book or begin his hardcore mudslinging at Malachy Martin until a couple of years after Father Martin was dead. Yeah. So there was no chance of him being sued for slander or defamation of character.
Yeah.
So that says something.
Yeah, I mean, I was slated for including him in the film, but he was the only one of Father Martin's, I would say, critics that was willing to come forward and come on record. There was a lot of mudslinging on telephone calls and emails and social media comments, but no one was willing to come forward and to stand by their beliefs I was giving them a platform. It was only Bob Kaiser who said yes, and one of the reasons why he knew he was dying, I met him at the hospice, and he was actually the first interview I conducted of the whole project. And I gave him a platform. It was respectful. We got on really well. It was pleasant. But you can see in the film, he still had this core hatred for the man, and that will be
he did.
That will go with him to his grave. But I gave him.
Well, the other thing I was going to say was, in the movie, I remember when you were interviewing him, Robert Kaiser explicitly denied that hell existed.
Yeah.
You know, he says, and I think he said something to the effect of, I know Pope Francis says there is a hell, but personally, I don't believe it. I guess I'm going to find out when I die.
Yeah.
That's a bold statement for a man on the standing on the edge of eternity.
Yeah. Yeah, true. Very true. Moving the focus back to your new book then. So
sure.
Obviously you talk about like if you were to Google Malachy Martin into YouTube, it's full of Art Bell and Bernard Jansen content, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to offer audiences and readers? What are you going to offer them in regards to stories that haven't been told yet?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4/6 Success Filmmaking. 4/6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4/6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
I'm going to offer then the aspects of Father Malachy's life that never made it into a Bernard Jansen or Art Bell interview. Most people don't know about his activities in the 1950s, shortly after his ordination as a Jesuit priest. He was ordained in 1954, and a couple of years later, he was sent on missions by either the Pope or at the direction of the Pope behind the Iron Curtain. And there's an entire chapter dedicated to what he did behind the Iron Curtain insofar as supporting and helping to set up the underground church and the price that he paid for doing so. Most people have no idea about that. I know about it because, number one, he told me about it. And number two, back in the 1990s, when he was still alive and he told me these things on occasional trips down to Washington, D.C., as I said, I've made no secret of the fact I used to be a CIA operations officer, and I was able to delve into records that are accessible to no one else. But I was able to delve into CIA I think they were microfilm archives that corroborated I would say about 85% of what he told me. And I would say the 15% that it didn't corroborate, it's because the agency didn't know about.
Yep.
So there's no doubt in my mind that these events happened. So, and I think people will find that to be of great interest. They'll also find out in a different chapter about a different side of Father Martin. Because when people hear about Malachy Martin, you know, the first image that comes to mind is the fearless priest holding up a crucifix, commanding Satan to leave someone as an exorcist. And there's actually a very poignant chapter in the book where he was instrumental in the miraculous healing of a young woman who had what's known as AML leukemia, which apparently is the most deadly kind of leukemia. He was instrumental in her healing, and I was there to witness it. I mean, I was there. I saw. It's not like I heard a story.
Yeah.
I saw it. And, you know, the family was, you know, to this day, they are profoundly grateful because they believe that Father Martin saved her life. So there are going to be aspects of Father Malachy Martin's life that I'm going to bring to light. I'm also going to be clarifying things that people have either through innuendo or outright accusation accused him of. For example, they've accused him of having an inappropriate romantic or sexual relationship with his landlady, Mrs. Lovanos. And if anyone knew Mrs. Lovanos at the time, she was a very stern woman, brilliant artist. But she was a very stern woman who functioned as Father Malachy's gatekeeper, so to speak. And she basically kept the wing nuts at bay on the telephone.
Yes.
And
just to remind the audience that he used to, in the Art Bell show, used to actually give his, well, it wasn't his phone number in the end. It was Kakia's, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And he even gave postal address over to over the Art Bell show. Art Bell told me to my face that he warned Father Martin many times, do not do this over the radio, but he was insistent that he was gonna, you know, give us contact details. So I'm sure he was inundated with a lot of
He was. Because the other thing I was going to mention is that Malachy and Mrs. Lovanos are buried side by side.
Yeah.
In a Gate of Heaven cemetery up in Westchester, New York.
Yeah.
And people point to that and they kind of take it out of context in an aha kind of moment. But what they don't realize is Malachy died before Mrs. Lovanos. He had no say in where she was interred.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I know for a fact there was nothing inappropriate going on. If anything, she was a protector and uber landlady for him.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Are you going to talk about the another sort of, I don't want to say conspiracy theory, but another theory that he was a secret bishop, and this ties in with the Cold War stuff?
Yes, exactly. I'm going to say as much of that as I am able to. One problem is that it's not really a problem. It's just the perspective that the book is being written from. It's a biographic memoir. It's not going to be a traditional nonfiction book wherein, you know, you're going to have 18 pages of footnotes at the back with literary citations. You know, if someone says, well, I had a conversation with so-and-so and here's what they told me, the best thing I could compare it to would be, and this is by no means to put down or to diminish the horror and the sorrow of their story, but if you were to interview a Holocaust survivor from Hitler's Shoah in World War II, and they told you about their personal experiences, they would be horrifying, but no one would think to say, well, that happened a long time ago. And although we have general outlines, records, and, you know, the locations of the camps and museums, etc., but what specifically you were told by so-and-so, or what such-and-such camp guard or Oberfuhrer said to you in the camp, you can't prove that. It's hearsay. But the thing is, no one would dare to challenge the integrity of someone like that. And I'm just putting the facts out there because I'm the last person able to do so.
Yeah.
And there will be pictures, as you realize, the saying that's become very popular, pictures or there's no proof or it didn't happen. And I have the pictures.
Well, you can't trust pictures nowadays, you know, with AI.
There you go. There you go. Well, I guess I'm not going to be able to use the picture of him playing a ping pong with President Kennedy then.
it gets to a point where, like just to go back on my point before about constantly trying to prove a fact or a story, or it just... You just got to let it go, and then let him speak for himself. If when you hear Father Martin talking on the Art Bell show or whoever it is he's being interviewed by, you know, just what if he's saying stuff and it's resonating, then take that on board. You know, it's this, you have to prove everything. And I stopped being a journalist about the whole process, and I just became a storyteller myself, and that's when sort of the film sort of took its a life on its own. But I think really all you've got to do is do the story justice. And like you said, I think the timing's perfect. I think I'm at a stage in my life, my personal life and my spiritual life, where I've got something really serious to say now, and something important to say. And I think that's probably with yourself as well. You're in that state now where you have something to say now, hence why you've written an incredible book for your debut, The Ebenezer Scrooge Story. I just think, yeah, like you say, the timing, you know, the timing is all part of it's from a spiritual point of view, I believe timing is it's not a coincidence, it's all part of the plan.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people have very generously donated to the fundraising campaign.
Yeah.
And what I'm looking to do is, you know, if I can be allowed just a couple of minutes to explain the why. In traditional publishing today, if you're lucky enough to get a literary agent, which I kind of stumbled into getting one at the Paradigm Talent Agency, and they're fairly well known. They're up there with William Morris and Creative Artists, and I do believe Father Martin was behind that happening.
Yeah.
Well, what they told me was, unless you plan to just self-publish it and, you know, bring it to the cliff overlooking the great sea of Amazon, shove it and see what happens. You have to do is, for traditional publishing, you have to produce a 40 to 50 page proposal, much the same way when I was a business consultant, we're proposing to do a big job at a bank. We would have to do a very large, detailed and explanatory proposal.
Yeah.
It's no different in the traditional publishing world. And what happens is your agent takes this proposal and he shops it around to the various large publishing houses. And you have to have sample chapters in there, a table of contents. You've got to have a breakdown of what each chapter will address. You have to have explanatory annotations that basically call out, what are you looking at in this photo? Not only that, you have to have a marketing plan. You have to convince the publisher that you will be able to have the publicity reach in order to have the publisher turn a profit, basically. And that's where I have to go with there are actually people out there who specialize in producing these proposals, literary proposals, and they are not cheap.
Yep.
So that's one of the things that I have to look at. And then in the event that a large publisher does not take the bait and say, okay, we'll publish the book, in the event that doesn't happen, I'm still going ahead with publishing the book anyway. And on the Give, Send, Go campaign, on one of the updates, I specifically call that out and say, if in the event I end up having to try to write this by myself, I'm going to use some of the funds to get a discounted version of the Dragon 16 dictation software. And in the event there's some ghost writing needed, all of that adds up into the many thousands of dollars very quickly.
Yeah, I think transparency is key with when you're asking people for money. I think you're very transparent on your fundraising page, and that's all you can be, is transparency. There are costs involved, and as long as you're transparent with those costs, and you know, obviously times are quite hard for everybody at the moment. So if they believe this is a great cause, then yeah, they at least they know where their money's going. I think it's
well, that's why I'm very cognizant of that fact. Times are hard for many people, and I'm profoundly grateful, and I say this in my updates on the campaign page, whether someone gives $5 or they give a large amount that I never saw coming, I'm profoundly grateful for everyone who's contributed, regardless of the amount. I sincerely am. And the other thing I ask them is, just as important, are your prayers, because this is a project that must get done.
Yeah, but on resist, I find at the moment, especially over the last few years, like resistance is, it's depicted in two ways. Some people believe when they feel resistance to something, they feel like, oh no, it's not right for them. They move on to something else. But for me, from a spiritual sense, resistance means that this is worth fighting for. So not being able to find a home for Hostage of the Devil is resistance to me. Not being able to find a home for my new film, Afghanistan, is resistance, because basically, it's important. It's you know, it's an important project. And it's the same with you with this book. You will face resistance. You will face natural resistance because this is a book that needs to be told and needs to be out to a wider audience. So just be wary of that. Remind me of the name of the book. I remember you told me the name on the phone the other day and it really struck a chord. What's the name of the book?
The working title of the book is, the main title is Malachi Martin, and its subtitle, Christ's Priest Against the Approaching Scream of the Ancient Beast.
Nice, mate. That's good. Yeah. You've got my attention. So
it took a long time to come up with that title. And one of the things behind that title is not specifically exorcism related, but what he saw as, I believe, what one American historian about 25 years ago had a book entitled Slouching Towards Gomorrah.
Wow. Okay.
And that is pretty much echoing the sentiment of that book, that Western culture and the church were headed towards an inflection point and confrontation with evil. And as you pointed out with a clip you had from Father Martin in the movie Hostage to the Devil, that there is a battle between Christ and Lucifer in the arena of men's souls.
Yeah.
And while it's a foregone conclusion that Jesus Christ won the victory forever and all time on Calvary by his passion, death, and resurrection, where the battle is still being waged in the arena of men's souls, is because people have free will and we are not robots. We can make a free choice.
Yep.
Some choose Christ, some choose to serve Lucifer. It's free will, and God does not violate that. If I might, I'd like to give you the actual address of the campaign. Would that be okay?
Yeah. Well, we'll stick the link in the show notes. But talk us through, you know, how long you got left to raise the money?
I have approximately 3 weeks left to raise the money.
Okay.
And then I'm shutting the campaign down because it's not going to turn into something that's just going to be out there in dribs and drabs. There will be an end date on or about November 18th, 19th, thereabouts, because Ralph Sarchi, who we both know, has very kindly agreed to support me via something similar to what we're doing today, except it's going to be a week from Saturday. So he has my gratitude. The campaign itself can be found at www. And this is all one word, givesendgo.com. And then all they have to do is in the search bar, type in Malachi Martin book, and it'll bring them right to the fundraising site.
Great. And I'll have the link in the show notes as well for everyone to click on. Because I'm a tight arse, and I have not upgraded Zoom, we've got 5 minutes left. Please talk to me about, summarize the book for me. What can readers expect to read from this book?
They can expect to read the story, the untold parts of the story of the life of every mystical and holy priest of Jesus Christ, who was much maligned throughout his life. But those people who knew him and knew him well, knew him as a very, very holy priest. That's what they're going to find out. They're going to reach the end of the book. And I believe that if they read it objectively and with an open mind, they will have a new and very positive view of the Reverend Dr. Malachi Martin. And that's my ultimate purpose, to tell this true story, because he was a mystically holy man in some ways that many people don't know about. And I believe I know a very good friend of mine who said he once had a mystical vision of sorts in which he was walking down a crowded New York City street, and he saw Father Martin standing in the distance, and he was walking towards him, and he got closer and closer and closer. I believe you know who I'm talking about, Marty.
Yeah.
Yes. So what this book is going to do, it's going to bring people to the moment where that person would have shook hands with Father Martin and realized the true person that he was.
Well, when it happened to me, he held his hand out, and as I was about to, just obviously, sorry for listeners and for viewers who don't know the story, whilst making the film Hostage to the Devil, I had a vision of, I was in New York. It was a bustling pedestrians, civilians everywhere, and I was walking down the street, very busy street. People were bumping into me. I was very on edge. People were aggressively bumping into me and trying to intimidate me. And then I obviously saw the small stature of Father Martin standing there with a smile on his face. And as I got closer and closer, the jostling and the bumping and the violence intensified. And then Father Martin, again, with a smile on his face, held out his hand. And as I was about to touch his hand, I sort of came back to present day, in a sense. So for me, that was a powerful reminder that he had my back whilst making the movie.
Exactly. That you'd face challenges, but ultimately he had your back.
Yeah. He was, although small in stature, he was a rock. He was stood there in the street. He was smiling. He was unmovable. And
that's why I feel compelled to write this book. You know exactly why.
Right.
You know exactly.
All I asked for is a signed copy, mate. That's all I asked for.
Oh, you know, you already know you're getting. You already know you're getting.
All right, mate. So, it's just to wrap up then. Yeah. So, the link will be in the show notes. You've got a few more weeks to raise the money.
Correct.
I don't want to be a sort of downer. What happens if you don't reach your intended target? Are you going to continue on by yourself? Will take longer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Great. Yes, I'm going to press on no matter what, because this must be done. I owe it to Father Malachy, and I owe it to, in a sense, posterity, to speak the truth and to just put it out there and let people judge for themselves. But at least my conscience will be clear.
Beautiful, mate. Beautiful way to wrap up the show, mate. Again, thanks again for coming on to the podcast. To all the listeners and the viewers, thank you for your patience. I've been away busy with work, but I feel now is a good chance and opportunity to sort of kickstart the podcast again. So great to have you on the show, Robert, and good luck with the launch.
Thank you very much, Marty. You know, it's always a pleasure to see you, my friend.
Thanks for listening to our podcast, and remember about our Facebook page where you can find out more information about our documentary. If you have some spare cash, then please buy us a coffee over at buymeacoffee.com/HTTD podcast to help us keep this podcast going. And it would only be right to finish with the main man himself.
Now, before we went to break, we were talking about, you know, the deterioration of the Catholic Church, and we were talking about...
As an organization. Yeah.
Let's talk about why this is occurring.
Yeah. Before we do that, we should make it clear to, at least I should make my mind clear to our listeners, namely that we make a radical distinction between the institutional organization composed of bishops and priests and dioceses and parishes and institutes and schools and universities and libraries, between that, the institutional organization, and what we call the mystical body of Christ. And what is that? It is the assemblage of all those in a state of grace, what Roman Catholics call the state of grace. And they are either in heaven, or they're in purgatory, or they're on earth, and they're observant Catholics.
Okay.
There's a distinction between those two elements that make up the Roman Catholic Church.
Okay.
Now, what is deteriorating is the organization. It's our own doing. It was done by us to us. It was done by three popes, followed by their bishops, to the institutional organization. Why? Because of a meeting held in the 1960s, from 1962 to 1965, where a very clever, parliamentarily sage group of cardinals and bishops, under the prodding of two popes, decided to draw up a blueprint for the church in the future, which would effectively liquidate the central mystery of Catholicism, which is the Mass, and which would reduce the status of the Pope, and that's a key element, reduce the status of the Pope to the status of the first among equals. And both of those things require explanation, but it was a blueprint drawn up, and it's taken just about 30 years to implement. And John Paul II, Pope John Paul II, the present Pope, has achieved finally the complete deterioration of the organization itself. Now, you can ask, what is the motive? Why? The motive, I think, is misguided, of course, and was wrong in its calculation.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a great urge in the 60s at that meeting of the bishops. There were 2,800 of them, by the way, gathered in St. Peter's for 3 years.
Now, this is Vatican II you're talking
Vatican
about.
Vatican II, from 1962 to 1965. The spirit amongst them, and fomented by the popes in question and by the cardinals, and the cardinals are very important officials around the Pope, the spirit amongst them was, at all costs, at all means, let's get with the world. We've been isolated. We're antediluvian. We are not talking to modern man as modern man understands talk. We're not with him in building his habitat. We've been too busy with our own spiritual matters and theological developments and converting people. Let's take a completely different attitude and let's join the world. And let's modernize everything. And the big word that John the 23rd used was aggiornamento, which means bringing things up to date. Now, that was their spirit. And in order to do that, they jettisoned, in the Vatican Council, they jettisoned sacred traditions that had always been traditions in the Catholic Church back to the time of the first popes in the first century, Peter, Linus, Cletus, Clement, and all the others.
Mm-hmm.
They jettisoned those and substituted more modern-sounding doctrines, especially on two or three capital points. One was about human liberty, the other was about marriage, the meaning of marriage and the purpose of marriage. A third was concerning the Holy Father, concerning the Pope's authority. On those three points, they changed completely the organization of the Church. Now, why did they do it? I think it was a mistaken zeal to belong to the modern world, to catch up with it. And we have caught up with it in the sense that, you know, Michael, today, if you study any country at all, even someplace, some mess of a country like North Korea or Albania, you'll find that, but in all normal countries, you'll find always there are three components and only three. The first important component is the government. Government is terribly important nowadays, much more important than it was for our grandfathers and grandmothers.
Mm-hmm.
And the second component is the business community. And it's in many countries, it's more important than the government, as in Switzerland or in Russia, modern Russia, and in the United States. Business is the fulcrum that moves the whole country.
It's the big thing.
And the third component is what we call that rabble of NGOs, non-governmental organizations. Everything from the International Firemen's Association to Mothers Against Drunk Driving to the Catholic Church and to all the churches. We are just NGOs. It's a name taken from the United Nations. And we're in the marketplace. We're no longer consulted, especially by anybody. No church is. All governments are independent of that. Even the so-called Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran and all those. The religion has very little to do with the way the government is run. The change is that the church is now competing in the marketplace and competing with the weapons of competition, not with its spiritual power, not with his spiritual power.
And therein lies the conflict.
As losing the battle, because the only weapons put in the hands of the church by Christ, who founded the church, are spiritual weapons.
That's it.
So that's where I think the difficulty started. Now, so much so, Michael, that, and this is going to shock some of the, even our non-Catholic listeners, we have now, the Catholic Church, in its latest statistical index, has just published that Catholics number 1 billion plus.
Wow.
Out of 5 billion, a population of 5.5 billion. And yet, you can safely say, if you're going to be frank, and of course, as the British say, bloody-minded, you're going to tell the truth and say that certainly two-thirds of those Catholics throughout the world, Latin America, Europe, Asia, Australia, Canada, USA, two-thirds are being led by the nose, unknowingly, out of the Catholic faith, because they're not taught the Catholic faith as it was always taught.
Is this part of we'll answer this after the break, but is this part of a larger grand design by someone?
Well, the only person who really designs history is Christ.
Okay.
He is the king of history.
All right.
And therefore, it's what he has in mind that we should concentrate. Of course, there are little plots and plans, and there are little foolish little lodges of Freemasons making their plots and plans, and there are still communists, and there are still anti-Catholics, and there are still sort of official atheists. There's everything as gross as NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, up to, something like Maurice Strong runs, sort of natural religion and recourse to a completely earthly life. But that's not that's all detail. There is a master designer of human history, and he's called Christ.